Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we discuss Volodymyr Zelensky's speech to the World Economic Forum's annual meeting at Davos, look at the impact of mounting Russian casualties, and get the lowdown on the new Terminator tank Russia says it has deployed in the Donbass.
This hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure.
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Monday, the 23rd of May, day 89. And today I'm joined by the Telegraph's defence and security editor, Dominic Nichols, and assistant comment editor, Francis Sternley. I started by asking Dom for the latest updates from the battlefront.
Hi, David. Hi, everybody. It's been another weekend of artillery duels in the Donbass. That seems to be Russia's main effort at the moment, possibly their only effort. And the Russian Defence Ministry put out this statement that is so rich on detail, it makes me question the accuracy, but then maybe that's just me. They put out this thing saying that over the weekend, the Russian artillery has hit 73 command posts, 578 areas where troops and equipment have been massing, 37 artillery and mortar positions in a position to fire, air defense systems and et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on and on. I mean, it's a bit in the sort of zone of Salisbury having a 123-meter spire. It's so specific, it just makes me think more if it's gone into preparing the PowerPoint presentation for the boss rather than actually fighting in the Donbass. But I mean, there has been. I don't mean to make light of the violence in the Donbass, but I think we should just treat. You should always treat all figures with a certain degree of skepticism. It's very confusing in war. The first casualties are invariably casualty numbers or any other figures are invariably wrong. So treat them all with a degree of skepticism at the best of times. And I think when the Russian offensive has, if not stalled, then every small mile advantage they are gaining, it comes at a huge cost in terms of personnel and equipment. I think we should just be a little bit cute at not drinking the Kool-Aid and buying into these figures too much. But it's been very violent in the Donbass. Elsewhere, just to note, this morning, just in the last hour, we've heard that the Russian soldier, Vadim Shishimarin, 21-year-old guy in a tank unit, he's been on trial for killing the 62-year-old Ukrainian man on February the 28th. He's been found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment. So there will undoubtedly be fallout from that. He had pled guilty to killing Alexander Shelepov, but it said he was acting under orders and he'd been told to do so because Mr. Shelepov had been on his phone and it was deemed that he might be reporting on their position or for whatever reason. Anyway, he was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment. Other than that, President Zelensky is speaking now in Davos. I think Francis is going to speak to us a little bit more on that. And there's more fallout over the New York Times article discussing what the future should be for this war and Kiev's approach to any negotiations. But more of that in a minute.
Thanks, Dom. Yes, let's go to the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos. It's postponed from January. Usually it's in January. Now it's in May, I think, because of coronavirus. President Volodymyr Zelensky has appeared there to address the World Economic Forum by video link. Francis, what did he say? And what new things has he said that we can comment on?
Good afternoon, everyone. And yes, you're right that President Zelensky has been speaking in the last few minutes. And so all of this is still being analysed carefully by commentators, including ourselves. But essentially, there are several key messages that were coming out of this. I think probably the most interesting one is, first of all, about the vision that President Zelensky is trying to sell of his country post the war. And I think already it's interesting, isn't it, that President Zelensky is talking about what his country it seeks to be long term. I don't think we would have necessarily been in that situation when the war began. Obviously, we're almost 3 months in now. So that in itself is an interesting development. But one of the big things that he's talked about in relation to this vision is talking about foreign investment. He says that it will require substantial investment in order to rebuild. But also, it's clear that he's articulating a vision of Ukraine that is clearly leaning more towards the West, unsurprisingly. And he says he wants to create the conditions where people and businesses aren't afraid to exist and thrive in Ukraine. And he says that he wants it to be a modern state and with an up-to-date defense system, modern multifold defense and security, and a cooperative defense system of arrangements with countries that we respect. So clearly laying out some groundwork here for a vision of a Ukraine that's heavily tied to sort of Western capitalism. But also, and I think this is perhaps the most revealing aspect of the of what he said in terms of revealing his inner frustrations, is he talks about how the war could have been prevented if the West had acted sooner to impose sanctions. So he says, oh, we're grateful, and this is a quote, we're grateful for this support. But if it had happened back then, would Russia have started this full-scale war? I'm sure the answer to this question is also no. And he says that he's now calling for maximum sanctions, calling for a Russian oil embargo and sanctions on all the banks, and saying there should be no trade with Russia at all. So clearly a very impassioned appeal, as we would expect from President Zelensky. But I'm sure there'll be a lot of fallout that will come from this in the coming hours. Just one other thing I would just highlight in the context of Davos. There's been some very interesting analysis coming out of interviews that have been taking place with senior business leaders present at the Congress, and they have been saying effectively this is the end of the era of globalization as it's been understood since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So effectively, this idea that we were on a path of a closer, more closely integrated world where liberalism and democracy was slowly spreading around, and this would be precipitated by capitalist forces, is now over. We're seen as being naive. You know, essentially, it's putting the nail in the coffin to Francis Fukuyama's end of history thesis, and effectively saying that this era is ending, and that the world economic strategy must be adapted accordingly, as there is a prioritizing of energy security and, of course, food security. But we'll come on to that later on. But I'll pause there.
Thanks very much for that, Francis. There's also an interesting story, I think, Francis, we should pick up on. It was our front page yesterday in The Telegraph. To do with, and I know we've spoken about this on the podcast recently, the production of grain, and how in the UK there's a plan to increase the supply of gene-edited crops in the wake of the conflict in Ukraine. Can you talk about this, and what relevance does that have?
Yes, well, as part of this, this sort of, since the war began, there has been profound questions, obviously, as I say, asked about energy security, but also food security. Ukraine, obviously known as being the breadbasket of Europe, its traditional role in providing grain and other vital supplies for food production. This is having big ramifications, by the way, not only in Europe, but in Africa as well, where already there are obviously serious issues around food supplies in recent years. As a consequence of this, there's now much more of a return to thinking about what it would mean where you are not as reliant on other nations such as Russia or Ukraine or anywhere that might be destabilized long term. And as part of this is a renewal of investment in gene editing. This is something that Britain has always actually been a pioneer at, but puts into some extent the argument goes that the government have said is that Brexit, before Brexit, its hands were sort of tied due to EU regulation. But now, as a consequence of Brexit, the hope is that they will be able to guarantee British food supplies in the wake of the conflict in Ukraine, not only through thinking more deeply about food security, but also by investing in these gene edited crops. Now, of course, gene editing has actually been quite controversial in the past, but I think that this is showing that, from as they say, the old political mantra, from chaos springs opportunity. And of course, the war has meant that this has now become a priority. And so there are renewed efforts in the space. And I would point people to read a very interesting piece of analysis we've got. It was published in the paper on Sunday, I believe, by Matt Ridley. But it will also be online, which talks about more broadly about the importance of gene editing in crops and why this is important. So this will be another big priority, I'm sure, being discussed at Davos. But I just wanted to ask, David, because I know that you used to work behind the scenes at Davos. So what insights can you offer? I'm putting you on the spot here, but what insights can you offer from how things actually operate there and what is likely to be being discussed?
Yes. So the context of this is I was in the media team there for 3.5 years. So I did 3 Davoses. I worked on 3 of the annual meetings, usually behind the camera interviewing people for the social media videos, essentially, of the World Economic Forum. I would say the interesting things that spring out of what we're seeing so far in this week is that, well, first of all, you've got to understand that there's sort of 2 Davoses. There's the official invite only a conference center where you need a top level pass, and that's for the events run by the forum itself. So that's so Volodymyr Zelensky will be speaking to the Congress Hall for those invitees, and there are numerous other absolutely loads of other speakers, other events inside the Congress Hall. Outside the Congress Hall, it's a different story. It's often where companies and countries will sort of set up their stalls. So you have different countries will run their sort of, well, you have like Russia House or Ukraine House, or the United Kingdom might rent the front of a shop and show off its attract investment and host parties and so on. That's not official Davos. That's a bit different. So you can see, when I was working there, Russia House was very big. It was very close to the Congress Center. It would host lots of evenings, lots of soirees, lots of free vodka. Russia House is not a thing this year. It's somebody has got together and they've done a Russian war crimes house instead. So you do get a sense within the Congress Hall of the incredible support for Ukraine. I mean, the forum came out to publicly support and show solidarity with Ukraine, I think on the 27th of February, so just a few days after the war began, which is relatively unusual, I think, for the forum to take such a strong position on something like this. And it doesn't do so for other big international issues sometimes. And then outside the Congress Centre, in the more business orientated, sort of not the hangers on as such, but the businesses and the execs who go to Davos just to be there, you can also see that. So as I said, the absence of the Russia House and its replacement with the Russia War Crimes House. So I think you can sort of see the mood music and how that's playing. I mean, both Klitschko's are there, I think, as well. They've gone to Congress and are giving a session inside the Congress Center as well. So there's a huge Ukrainian presence, and of course zero Russian presence at all. So I think there are some interesting things over this week to bear in mind. Those would be my thoughts anyway.
Yeah, sorry, I mean, bear with a small brain. So I'm not intricately involved with Davos. Never have been. Don't really understand how it works, etc. So basically, for both of you, what can you point to show me its value? I mean, Davos gets bashed every year for having Bono turn up and all the rest of it, and it's all it's written off as part of the circuit for people to turn up to. But I'm not that naive that I can't think that there'll be some benefit to it. But what can you show me outside of the sort of deep policy sphere that might be readily apparent? But what can you show me as a sort of lay member of global society? Show me what the value of Davos, please, guys.
Well, that's the question I think my former colleagues grapple with and try to explain every single day. I would say very quickly that you have a week in the year where almost everybody who's incredibly important from in economic sense, in terms of leaders of business,
top scientists, policymakers from around the world are actually in the same place. So they get to talk to each other, sometimes one-on-one, sometimes in a group. They get to meet each other and see each other in the flesh and talk about the world and what they want to do. That connection and that proximity, I think, is the selling point of Davos. I mean, from a business perspective, if you're an exec, you can go to Davos and you can do more business there in a couple of days than you would in weeks, rather than flying around the world and going to all of your different offices. Suddenly, you can make sure the CEOs you want to connect with are just in the same place. And I think it's that same logic does operate for political leaders as well. I mean, it kind of sometimes people use it to announce their new policy change. So, Xi Jinping goes there, he says certain things, and it's supposed to show what China is. Joe Biden or Trump, for example, the other year went, and it's used as a podium. Zelensky's going there because he knows that all the people in the world, all the big policymakers and business people and so on, are watching him quite closely. So it's, for him, potentially, it's another way of spreading his message.
Okay, thank you. I get that. In which case, if this is one step to the side of politics, then do you think it's wise to exclude Russia? Because if a large part of what might unseat Putin, or at least make him think again, is the money, is the oligarchs around him saying, "Look, fella, we've had enough of this. You need to move things on a bit." Surely that's where you want to have a Russia house. It's great that there's a Russia war crimes house, but do you not want Russia there to take some of these messages back through the medium of money?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. That would have been, if there was internal debate over whether to suspend Russia from Davos when they did, that would have been the argument against that. As a forum, its job is to try and convene people from every background. As I said, I was a relatively lowly grunt member of the team, so we'd probably have to speak to somebody from the forum to get their take on that. I know we have our reporter Tom Rees out there, so I'll try and call him before the end of the week for the podcast to get his take on the forum's attitude and what's actually happening in Davos. Francis, do you want to jump in?
Well, I would just say one other thought on Davos and its significance. The question that that Don was just mentioning there is, of course, very relevant as well in the context of the United Nations, which is, as there were obviously, as we've spoken about many times, there were calls for Russia to potentially be removed from its permanent seat at the Security Council as a consequence of this. Now, how should one have a seat at the Security Council when you are invading a sovereign democratic nation? Perfectly valid point, and I think there'll be many people who would agree with that stance. But of course, the challenge of this is that what would be the point in doing so when the function of the United Nations, however inefficient and flawed, one could argue it is. What is the point of it if you don't actually have all of the key players in the room? That is its central purpose. As at Davos, there's a lot of backroom conversations, a lot of relationships that are formed between diplomats that can have, big ramifications. Ultimately, politics is a people game, and we elect politicians to represent us. And those relationships that are formed in back rooms, over a drink or two, can have huge geopolitical significance. And so I think that is one of the functions of Davos. However uncomfortable it may make us feel as democratic people, it serves an important purpose. And, we don't know how important some of these relationships that are being forged right now are, but with Ukraine being at the forefront, that's bound to have significant implications long term.
Thank you, Francis, and thank you, Dom. Let's move on now to the outrage caused in Kyiv by an editorial in the New York Times. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about because it's, as we said, it's caused a lot of outrage. But I want to ask whether it had a point. What was it arguing? Why are so many Ukrainians upset by this? Francis, do you want to take this?
Sure. Well, it's a very interesting opinion piece in the New York Times. I'll condense it briefly because it's quite a long piece of analysis. But essentially, it's asking, isn't the inevitable outcome of this war a compromise that preserves Ukrainian sovereignty but cedes Russia some territory? And if so, shouldn't the West push Kyiv to accept that reality before more lives are lost? So I'll read you a quote from the editorial. It says, a decisive military victory for Ukraine over Russia, in which Ukraine regains all the territory Russia has seized since 2014, is not a realistic goal, in the opinion of the newspaper. Ultimately, quote, it will be Ukrainian leaders who will have to make the painful territorial decisions that any compromise will demand. Now, as one can expect, this has caused considerable consternation amongst the Ukrainians, because as the war has gone on, their policy has shifted. And of course, Volodymyr Zelensky has very openly said that he would not be willing to cede any territory whilst he is president. And that would include, we assume, Crimea. Indeed, that has been a suggestion directly from him that he would not be willing to secede demands to have Crimea returned. Obviously, it was annexed by Russia in 2014. So this has, as you say, caused considerable frustration. Of course, on this podcast, we've spoken many times about this very issue. And I remember perhaps 2 months ago, so only a month into the war, we talked about this very issue because it seemed as if this may well be something not only favours the Russians in a sense by offering this off ramp, but also perhaps the Ukrainians, because they can lose some of the territory which has caused them issues in the past in terms of stability and other things. Now, of course, there's two things I would say about that. The first thing, as a critique of the New York Times is our argument, is that this idea that Russia is now going to be trapped in a long-term attritional war does not seem to be the view of most experts. So I'll be interested to hear Dom's take on this, because of this idea of a culmination point where ultimately the military effectiveness of the Russian army will be so severely diminished, perhaps within as short a period of time as 3 weeks, because of the attrition weights that we've talked about in this podcast in the past, that it will not be able to continue to fight and be operationally successful. And as a consequence of that, the war will not be able to be prolonged. So in that sense, this sort of assumption that the war is just going to go on and on for years would seem flawed, I would argue, in the New York Times. In the New York Times is analysis. The other thing I would flag, though, that's relevant to this question of the long term strategy for handling Ukraine, is that this is where the New York Times is actually onto something. Is this idea that it is actually showing the tensions now within NATO, and we're going to publish a piece, I think probably this evening, but it'll be certainly in tomorrow's newspaper, by Douglas Murray, obviously a well-known commentator. And he'll basically be arguing that in defeat, Putin is exploding the myth of NATO unity, because, you know, he has now effectively been humiliated by this war. But we're already starting to see several groups form, whether it be the Germans, the French, who want some kind of status quo as before the war to be returned, perhaps, you know, with some rebuilding of relations with Russia. Then, of course, you've got Poland and Britain that want to see an outright victory achieved again that would stop any further Russian expansion, and potentially even to lead to a sort of dethroning of Putin. So these tension lines are beginning to be formulated here, and I think that this is something that will be now defining the conflict longer term. And of course, and one other thing that's just, I think, related to both of these points is what Biden was saying. He's in Tokyo at the moment, and he said that now the US would intervene militarily to defend Taiwan in a future incursion by China. And if that's true, that is a very, very serious step forward into this more assertive foreign policy stance that America has offered previously, and may be seen as a reaction to what has been seen as a successful containment policy, as would have been more commonplace, operated by America during the Cold War. So that, again, is very, very, very interesting as well. And I think is suggestive of, as I say, some of the tensions that are within place in NATO about now the broader geopolitical strategy that Ukraine is offering. But as I say, very interested to hear Dom's take. I'm conscious I've spoken a lot there. I'm very interested to hear Dom's take on this idea around attrition rates and whether a long war in Ukraine is actually feasible for the Russian state.
I mean, my view is that yes, I think it is. I think it is feasible. There's been a long war there since 2014. The line was obviously further to the east, and it didn't include the south. But that line of control, as it's called, I mean, that's been there since the invasion in 2014, and it's not been static. I mean, there have been since 2014, 11,000 Ukrainian people killed, mostly service personnel, but a lot of civilians as well along the line of control. So whilst the line has been static, it has not been inactive. So I think it is possible that could continue, that model of a large chunk of Ukrainian territory held by Russia or Russian separatist forces for some time to come. Because if Russia have shown that they can't push further east. They tried it in the north around Kyiv, and they've just not been able to. And there have been no signs that they've learnt from their mistakes. I mean, they simply don't have a learning culture in the Russian military. But on this evidence, a learning culture is one that you look back at successes and failures, your setbacks as well as the bits you've done right, and you pull the lessons out of them. And then, I mean, in a rare moment of self-reflection, the British military has stopped talking about lessons learned. They now talk about lessons identified, because it's one thing to identify a lesson, it's quite another thing to learn from it. But until you've actually pulled those lessons out of the setbacks and the successes, and that has led to behavioural change, or at least organisational change, then you haven't learned from it. You've just sort of admired it and moved on. And Russia have just shown that they've not done that. Okay, they're in contact with Ukraine, and it's always hard to try and tie up one boxing glove with your teeth while the other boxing glove's trying to punch the other bloke in the face. So it's difficult to transform when you're in contact. It took the British Army or the Western forces 3 years to do it in the First World War, and so they managed to develop it in 2018 and then roll over to the east. It's very, very hard to do in contact with the enemy. But, you know, this is Russian army we thought we were talking about. They should have been able to do this, and yet what they've managed to do in the Donbass, they're only able to do this combined arms manoeuvre, so knitting together all the different parts of a military force, the infantry with the tanks, with the engineers and the artillery and the air and all the rest of it. They've only been able to do that on very, very small level, small tactical actions. They're making these small incremental advances. They've not been able to close that last sort of pocket, that salient around Severodonetsk. We've seen the trouble they've had trying to get over the river there. So this is not a learning culture in the Russian military. And therefore, I can't see any huge breakthroughs in the near future. There have been reports that Russia is going on to the transitioning to the defensive. The military term is culminated. So culmination is where you can no longer continue your offensive action. You're not necessarily going backwards, but you can't keep the fight going anymore. You're exhausted. Your equipment's broken, so on and so forth. You might be running out of money, running out of international allies, and so on and so forth. So it looks like Russia is approaching the point of culmination, but that means they're going to transition into a defensive posture. If they're already digging in and laying concrete into big defensive positions, then this ratio we talk about in military terms of an attacker needs a 3-to-1 advantage. Very, very generally, 3-to-1 advantage over a defender in order to succeed. That ratio goes through the roof when you get into urban combat, at least 5-to-1. More undoubtedly, I think, given the current weapons. So Russia at the moment have not been able to do that. They've not been able to get the combined arms manoeuvre thing going. They've not been able to get the ratio of 3-to-1. And so they are culminating. If they go on to the defensive, then, of course, it's going to be Ukraine who will then have to mass that 3-to-1 advantage if they want to push Russia back. And I don't think they can do that, even with all the support from the West in terms of equipment. You know, equipment does not a military make on its own. So I can easily foresee that this just grinds into some horrendous attritional battle along a new line of control, basically where the line is now. And I can see that enduring, well, until the next big event. I mean, the first one endured since 2014 to now, and this was the next big event. I mean, it doesn't augur well for the future, but I can see very easily that it does sort of just bake in to where it is at the moment. Now, so I don't think it's wrong at all to suggest that might be the future. What I think the New York Times article has done very interestingly is it's put this up for debate, and I can't, to be honest, the jury in my head is out on this one. I don't know if this was this piece of this editorial was a bit of mischief making or just throwing some thoughts out there, or if it was actually very, very clever and it's popping up these ideas to be backed up by others. And let me explain that. So at the moment, Ukraine, after the welcome surprise that it stayed in the fight after 72 hours, first and foremost, Russia thought they were going to knock them out in the first 72 hours. Ukraine managed to hang in there, and then this body from the West has finally come together, reluctantly in some areas, which we've discussed many, many times. But this sort of Western performance has finally rocked up and is supplying, first of all, a lot of money. Mostly from the White House, but also a lot of equipment and training and all the other bits and pieces. Now, as we've said before, each and each and every bit of that, each gun you send, each bit of money you send, each humanitarian aid package you send, has political risk attached to it. And we've discussed in the past how some countries might feel reluctant to take that political risk. Why would you want to send some S-300 air defense systems if Russia are eventually going to win? Then they're going to remember that. Why would you send companies or two companies worth or however many T-72s if you think you're eventually going to be on the wrong side? So this effort from the West has only managed to hold together because each country, you know, metaphorically, has looked left and right and gone, you with me? Yeah, okay, right, let's go. Let's do it together. And as soon as you start eroding that level of confidence, such that you're not sure that the country to the left and right of you is actually going to be there for you, then I can see some members of the alliance thinking, oh, do I really want to take this risk with this fancy new weapon, or do I want to be too overt in my expressions of disgust for what Russia have done in case they come out on top? And where I think this article, like I say, I can't tell if it was mischief or if it's an act of brilliance, this article has now given the space to people such as the Polish leader yesterday speaking in the Ukrainian parliament to overtly say, we're in it for the long haul. We are here. We're not going anywhere. And I think it's up for others to do the same. Now, of course, Putin will be very quick to point out any fissures in that model, any cracks. There's always this idea that, what is it, a tension, or is it the healthy debate in NATO or in the Western alliance? And what we might see is healthy debate, and it's good that people can voice different opinions and we can talk about it and carry our populations and societies with us. Putin will go, aha, there you go, that you're not fully in support. Let's attack that. The Western alliance is crumbling, etc., etc. So we've got to be careful about this tension versus healthy debate idea. But I do think that an article like this might give succor to those that would look for an easy way out, those that don't maybe not have the full confidence to go the distance, or people that want to try and make more of that than is actually the case. And so I say, if others now come out, and I don't denounce the article, it's perfectly good article, it's perfectly sensible ideas that are being thrown up and invited to critique. But I think it's now up to Western leaders to pick a side and explain their reasoning.
But just come back on one thing that you said there, Dom. Just genuinely, I'm very interested in this idea about that sort of whether this could become a long-term attritional war. You were talking about 2014 and how, you know, the war has essentially been going on since then, officially since the annexation of Crimea. But are we not in a different place now? Are we not in a situation where if the West really were to get behind Ukraine and say and agree with Zelensky that there cannot be any perceived territorial gain from the Russians, not only from when they started on February 24th, but even from prior to that, if they really got behind them, do you really think that the Russian army, with the Russian army's weaknesses that we've now seen in the last 3 months, that it would be possible for them to hold on to territory? I'm just interested, genuinely. I'm not positing a view there, but it seems to me that we're in a very, very different place than 2014, not least in the weaponry now that the Ukrainians have and the financial support and everything else. And I just wonder that if the will is there in the West, and if the will is there, certainly from the Ukrainian united people behind Zelensky, that I cannot see that this war perhaps would be able to go on for that long. But perhaps I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I don't think the two thoughts are mutually exclusive. I mean, I said that since 2014, that was an uneven and unhelpful pause in the conflict until a major event happened, and we are now living through that major event. I can see that, yes, if the Western alliance do stick together and continue to support and train Ukrainian forces, then they could prevail. That support and train is going to take a very, very long time in order to build a military force the size of which I think you're going to need to, if you wanted to eject Russian forces out of the whole of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. So what I'm suggesting is I mean, it's easy to say in short, medium, long term, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think in the medium term, which I would say is out to a year, 18 months-ish, I can see it very easily settling down, running this phrase, because nothing will be settled about it, but sticking into where the lines are now. And that major future event could well be a newly restructured, newly reformed and trained and equipped Ukrainian army pushing them out. That might be the fight to come in a few years' time. So, no, I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I think it will grind down to a horrible attritional battle along a new line of control. But there is always a possibility that the Russian army fractures and just simply... It's burned through so many of its tanks, and the stuff that it's pulling in now is old. And I mean, you only have to look at all the turret, the T-72 turret throwing competition that is still going on to this day. A lot of these turrets are landing with their ERA still intact, the explosive reactive armor, these big blocks on the outside that are designed to, when an incoming round hits the tank, they are designed to explode to physically push the round away to try and protect the turret. I haven't seen any ERA blocks going off, and that sort of speaks of. They're either old or unserviceable. It's all been traded away with in corruption and what have you. So I think the equipment that's coming online now is just not. It's just not up to it. So it could very easily fracture, and there might be some massive and very very sudden reversal in this war. We have spoken before on this podcast about, well, what does that mean? Is that the moment we talk about Putin? If his back's against the wall, would he resort to weapons of mass destruction? That might be it. If he suddenly seizes his supply lines, let's say in the north, Ukraine have done very well at pushing Russia back from Kharkiv to the north and east of Kharkiv, back to the Russian border in some places. If there was a sudden fracture and they accelerated 50-60 Ks to the east, cut off those supply lines coming down from Russia and were able to hold that territory, whilst at the same time maybe making a breakthrough in Kherson towards Crimea, then you might find that it just suddenly implodes like that, and that might bring on a whole another set of questions about how does Putin then react. I think that is possible, certainly in the north. I think that is possible, but I think it's more likely to bed in to a long, hard, horrific, grinding war of attrition. But hey, I've been wrong about many, many things across many, many years. So that's where I'd be thinking is going.
Just one more thing, David, before we move on this New York Times piece. I mean, as I say, I think it captures many of the tensions within NATO quite well that we've seen, of course, since the conflict began, about these different perspectives that I was talking about earlier on, whether it be between France, Germany, Poland, Britain, America, etc. But we're always talking about on this podcast, and I think in terms of often analysts and politicians, about this perception of victory or perception of defeat from the Russian perspective, and how significant that is. You know, we've talked many, many times about this idea of, like, you know, can Putin be allowed to be perceived to have won this war? And I just read an interesting comment by Timothy Snyder, who's the professor of history at Yale, who just made this observation, which is that we have to talk about that perception in two different ways. We have to talk about it from perception globally, from those, of course, who you know, surely, like, we are now sharing information, the analysis that we receive, and sharing it freely and democratically. And we can see that, you know, in many, many ways, this has been a disaster for Putin, not least in terms of Sweden and Finland now joining NATO, and the way in which it has unified Russia's foes, etc. So in that sense, of course, his perception has been a big failing. But the observation by Professor Snyder is that actually it's quite senseless to talk about this perception and this idea of needing to give Putin an off-ramp from the perspective of his own people, when we forget just the extent to which Putin is completely in control of the propaganda machine and the virtual world in Russia. I mean, he basically says that Putin's power over the media will be complete until the moment it ceases entirely. And there is no sign that it is going to cease entirely anytime soon. So essentially, he argues that this whole idea of Western foreign policy saying we need to give Putin an off-ramp so that he can save face is wrong. He doesn't need an off-ramp because he's only trying to appeal to his own people, and he has them locked in. Now, I'm not saying I would necessarily agree with that. I think that you know, the truth will always out. In theory, the Soviet Union was watertight intellectually, and that people were there was no free sharing of information. But of course, the Russian people knew the truth. And so when the system started to rot from within. It was very quickly able to fall down, and many people were happy to be free of that system, not least countries, of course, that were in theory behind the Iron Curtain against their will. But as I say, I think it's a worthy point, this, that if we're talking about giving Putin this off-ramp, and that essentially, I think, is the philosophy behind this New York Times article, that actually perhaps is a Western assumption that is wrong, that we don't need to give him that. That ultimately, at least from the perspective of the Russian people and arguably the Russian state, Putin has that under control. And in that sense, perhaps we should be going for harder and faster in trying to defeat Putin utterly. But anyway, I'm conscious I've hogged the microphone enough, so I'll stop there. I'm sure we've got other things to cover, David.
No, thank you very much, Francis, and thank you, Dom, for your thoughts as well. I thought it was important to devote some time to that because, as you said, it gets into the big questions that are that need to be answered by the Western powers. So thank you very much for your thoughts on that. Yes, let's talk about some of the numbers that Russia, the casualty numbers that Russia is suffering. Dom Nichols, do you want to take this? What's the latest on this?
Yeah, so this comes out of today's MOD, Ministry of Defence, Defence Intelligence report. They're just making the point that in their assessment, Russia have lost in the 3 months of this war the same number of personnel that they lost in the 9 years of the campaign in Afghanistan. Now, I mean, very different fights in mostly all ways. However, it's important to note that the casualties from Afghanistan did have a domestic blowback. They were remarked upon. That did lead to a lot of these mothers' groups forming, which put huge pressure on the system at the time. And so they're not drawing huge conclusions out of it, but they're just making that observation. I mean, Ukraine, numbers out of Ukraine are much higher. They say they're estimating 27,000 Russian casualties. We have learned over this campaign, we think initially we thought that that both sides would be, you know, massively over and underestimating their casualty figures. I mean, Russia haven't updated their figures for months, and you could argue why should they? Why would they? Why would any force give away figures? So I'm not saying they are, you know, they're wrong not to keep us all informed, but there's always a question mark over figures, as a point I've made many, many times. However, we have found, as the course of this war has gone on, the figures and assessments coming out of Ukraine have not been as wildly off the mark. This is in terms of Western sort of military analysis, as in state analysis, the MOD and the Pentagon. Not as wildly out as you might have thought in the beginning. However, there is a bit of a difference there. MOD saying that British MOD saying that about 15,000 Russian service personnel have been killed in 3 months. Ukraine saying 27,000. So a bit of a difference to be fair there. However, the more notable thing is that number did start to have domestic impact during the Afghan war. I mean, arguably a different society, perhaps. We have seen already in this war some pushback in Russian society. Whether or not this will stimulate even more, we don't know. But it is worth noting. It is a benchmark that they've just passed.
And Francis, I know you had some thoughts on the impact of the losses in Afghanistan for the future, the end of the Soviet Union.
Yes, I mean, just very briefly, it was very significant. The first thing to say, it was a very much longer conflict, as Don was saying. It lasted 9 years in Afghanistan, and as we've, of course, in the West experienced with Iraq and Afghanistan, in our own time, that when wars go on for a long time, it changes, however successful or non-successful they are, that duration has its own kind of bleeding effect on public morale and on attitudes towards war. But even so, the significance, I think, in terms of the impeding on the Soviet Union cannot be overestimated. It was hugely significant because it was seen as being at a moment when the Soviet Union was quite economically weakened, and so they sort of gambled on this on the invasion in Afghanistan and were quite publicly selling it as being this great triumph that would essentially have big ramifications on Russian power, but also would humiliate the West. And that is, of course, not what came to pass. And effectively, it showed the fundamental military weakness of the Soviet state at a crucial moment when many of the other nations behind the Iron Curtain were looking carefully about their own futures. And as we've spoken about many times, I think another shift that took place is that it helped precipitate the downfall of several other, several, uh, several other Soviet leaders prior to Gorbachev. And whatever the power of the Soviet state may well have been prior to Gorbachev, Gorbachev's becoming the head of the Russian state was the most significant thing that could have happened in terms of precipitating the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Iron Curtain, because what had shifted was not so much Russian power. I mean, I think that if it had not been Gorbachev in power and the Berlin Wall had started to collapse, then it may well have been possible for them to have put a stop to that. They could have sent the tanks in, and of course there would have been much bloodshed, but they had the power to do so. What the historian Tony Jutz argued, which I've spoken about several times on this podcast, is this fundamental point, which is that what had changed with Gorbachev coming in was this shift in the fact that they actually no longer believed in the hardcore ideology, Soviet ideology. They no longer believed in the Soviet military power, and as a consequence of that, tried to reform, tried to adapt, but because the whole system was rotten, ultimately it imploded. Now, of course, when we've been talking about in the context of this conflict, there are several echoes there, and I think many people would hope that perhaps some sort of future leader in Russia would share similar reluctances around the foreign policy and the strength of the Soviet state, but we don't know. But even so, I think it's a significant thing, and it's an example of where when the world is watching, it was a military humiliation and one that had severe ramifications in ways that could only be measured in a long time afterwards.
Thanks, Francis. Dom, one more question to you. We've got this report in that Russia is believed to have deployed Terminator tanks to the Donbass near Severodonetsk. Can you tell us a little bit about Terminator tanks? Are there myths to be busted here? What should we know?
Yeah, I think there's myths to be busted all over the place. So the Terminator tank is Russia's answer to tank vulnerability. So tanks, let's just go back a step. What is a tank? A tank is a military capability. It's a piece of equipment that is designed to do a number of things. If you put three people in a room, one who just wants mobility, just wants to be able to drive anywhere on the battlefield, one who wants firepower, as big a gun as possible, and one person who is only interested in protection to make sure that the tank, the vehicle doesn't get destroyed. Put those three people in a room, firepower, mobility and protection, and they're going to argue it out, and there's lots of trade-offs, and they will come up with a tank. And a tank is that military capability, is that piece of equipment that is the optimum mix for a battlefield of firepower, which obviously the in the army is spelled FAPA and pronounced FAPA, but firepower, mobility and protection. So you can't absolutely slather the thing in armor so that it can't get hit from any angle it can be hit from any angle and it will survive, because you just won't be able to move anywhere. You can't put a massive gun on it because the impact of firing those shells and the space inside the thing to have enormous great shells is such that you just shatter your suspension. And equally, you can't just have mobility. You can't just have a sort of quad bike or a kind of Range Rover type thing to go whizzing around the battlefield, because you won't be able to put any armor on it at all, or a gun, and it'd be completely useless. So, kind of in the same way a donkey is a horse designed by committee. You have all these trade-offs, and you get a bit of firepower, a bit of mobility, a bit of protection. And I apologise for any donkeys who may be listening. But, so firepower, mobility, protection, that's what a tank is. And a tank is there to take ground. It can't hold ground. You need infantry to physically hold ground. But a tank is a great asset to have. But, of course, it's vulnerable because it's big, heavy old lump. As we said, the majority of the armor is in the frontal 60-degree arc. So if you sit on a tank, if the tank turret is facing forward, the barrel is over the front decks and pointing forward, you're stood on the top of a tank and you hold your arms out at a 60-degree angle. That's where the armor is. So on the front of the hull and on the front of the armor. Because if you put armor absolutely everywhere, as I've just explained, you just can't move, and you're then even more vulnerable. So armor is only in a certain number of places. Tanks are very vulnerable from the sides, from the belly, from the back, and the turret. So what they found is, particularly from Russia's experience in the Chechen War in the early 90s, but also to extend the Georgia War in 2008, tanks are vulnerable, and they are even more vulnerable when you get into urban areas. Urban areas are tank killers. They really are, because you've got a subterranean environment. You have people moving around the subways and the underground networks, or through the sewers and through other pipes, et cetera, et cetera. You've also got the elevation. So you've got tower blocks where people can fire anti-tank missiles down onto that turret. As I said, the turret is fairly, it's not there's not a huge amount of armour except at the very front of it, so very vulnerable from the top. So tanks in an urban environment, they just get knocked out very, very easily. And so you need to protect them. Now, you can either protect them by having a squad of infantry moving to the left and the right of the tank, looking for these positions that might be firing from above on, down onto the tank, or looking for people popping up behind it out of the underground passages and so on and so forth. But that is fairly manpower intensive, and you actually, if you're an infantry, you're more interested in looking after you and your mates and your mission than making sure that massive lump of metal over there is protected. So it's tricky. So Russia have come up with this solution. This Russian tank supporting vehicle called BMPT in the Russian language. The manufacturers called it the Terminator. I mean, you know, fair play to them, come up with a fairly cool name. But you know, if you're going to start calling something a Terminator or the Invincibilator or something like that, then you're just asking for trouble, in my humble opinion. But there we go. So it's built on a T-72 chassis, and as we've seen, they're great vehicles, but they're, you know, a bit old, and they've had their problems in Ukraine. So a reasonably old chassis. But on top of that, you've got a thing that's basically got anti-tank guided weapons and automatic cannon and other sort of smaller caliber weapons. And what they are able to do is they've got particular elevations, so they can fire a lot higher than a tank main gun will. A main gun won't go up very high, and certainly not you won't have the situational awareness. You won't be able to, you know, physically have an idea of what's going on around you that you can direct fire onto all these various positions that might be firing back at you. So this Terminator is designed to support tanks in an urban environment and be able to pick out anyone who's trying to have a go at the main battle tank itself. But as I said, it is vulnerable. It's an old chassis, so it's just as vulnerable underneath and to the flanks and to the back as the tank it's there to protect. And also, I mean, for all that there's an automatic cannon and you've got these anti-tank guided weapons, which are all very, very capable munitions, but how much situational awareness do you have? If you're inside this hull and you're battened down, so you've got the lid shut, I mean, how much can you see? Even with modern systems, where you've got cameras all over the place and you can look up and down, I mean, you're going to be... they're going to be blinded by smoke and other battlefield obscurants, like, you know, dust and just the crap that flies through the air when you start throwing heavy metal around. And how much situation awareness do you have? How do you know when people are shooting at you or where they are and so on and so forth? So it is an answer to a problem. It's probably not the end of it all. It's very easy to think, oh my God, you know, they've brought out this thing to defeat whatever it is, anti-tank guided weapon teams. But, you know, it's always swings and roundabouts to these things. There's always a trade-off. There's one answer alone doesn't solve all the problems. So yes, let's take note of it. They do seem to be, there's a small number of these. I mean, I think only three, that's what British Defence Intelligence have suggested. Only three of these vehicles have been seen in Ukraine, in the Severodonetsk area. So they might be very capable, but I mean, Russia losing tanks a la Zubalaplatz. So are these three vehicles going to be able to turn the tide? I'm not entirely sure, but it is a thing. Unlike much amazing Russian equipment that we only ever see on the Victory Day parade and then never else, this is actually on the battlefield. So, you know, well done for turning up. But yeah, if it's as good, is it as good as the manufacturer would have us believe, by calling it the Terminator and saying it's there going to support the tanks? And we'll wait to see. But we think it got into theatre around about May the 18th. So not hugely long ago, but it's not as if it's added to a massive breakthrough yet. So one to take note of and to watch, but we should be under no illusion that there's like everything, every piece of military capability, there's all sorts of vulnerabilities, and there's always that trade-off between what it's there to do and the vulnerabilities it has to protect itself to be able to do its main role.
Thanks, Dom. That was incredibly comprehensive. I think we're probably out of time now. So, Dom and Francis, can I just get your final thoughts of what should we be looking for in the coming days this week?
I'll just pick up on something. I think there's going to be some big ramifications from Davos, of course, so follow that very closely. I said at the beginning of the podcast when talking about Davos that it would only just happened and we were there was bound to be some more analysis that comes out. That has taken place over the course of the recording of the podcast. Zelensky has said that Ukraine is in talks over establishing food corridors to export its grain, accusing Russia of stealing supplies. We talked about the food security, so I'm not going to bring it up again, but I would just flag that this is yet another example, I think, of President Zelensky being proactive rather than reactive. He can see, and this has been a defining feature, I think, of the Ukrainian handling of the war in terms of its dealings with the world and with its allies. It can see what the issue is and what the concern of its allies are, as I say, proactively, so that it can define the narrative earlier and not be have things done to it, but is seen to be assisting with those priorities. And I think it's a very astute and is just another example of where it's been one step ahead of Russia from the beginning. Because, as I say, I think, as we're talking about earlier, long term, the economic ramifications of this, the globalization ramifications of this, the energy security ramifications of this, and the food security and ramifications of this are going to be the big issues of the coming months and years. And it is very clever for Zelensky to be at the forefront of those conversations, because, of course, he wants to be to keep Ukraine as being one of the central proponents in Western discussions on all of these matters. So I would just highlight that and say, yes, there's going to be some more interesting things to come out of Davos, no doubt.
Thank you very much, Francis. Dom Nichols, would you like the final words?
Yeah, thanks. So linked to the point Francis is making, I mean, it's slightly away from Davos, but the whole idea of food security really is coming to a head now. You see the Kremlin saying that it's the West that's triggered this global food crisis by laying sanctions on Russia. Take your view on that if you wish. But this idea of the global famine that is being highlighted by the UN and many, many others, I mean, it is acute, and it's acutely... You could lay a huge amount of the blame for it right at Russia's door, and the ability for Ukraine to get its ships out of Odessa and elsewhere and through the Black Sea and what have you. And it's now becoming a world issue. If Russia continues this blockade of grain, and I know they're trying to get it through rail and road means, through Poland, Lithuania, Romania, elsewhere, trying to get the grain out, but the vast majority traditionally comes via the sea. And if Russia is still blockading it, and you've got the World Food Programme and other agencies highlighting the impact it's having across the world, then this is not just a problem. Russia's not just got a problem with Ukraine here. Russia's going to have a problem with the world, and this there could be. I can't see how Russia see this in their interest to keep this going, because they're just inviting more sanctions and more action and more military support. And if that then gets fed into shoring up that political support we were talking about earlier, that will go some way to sort of denting some of the knocks that may have been invited by the New York Times article. So there you go, wrapped it all up in a oneer.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 30 days completely free at telegraph.co.uk/audio. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. Ukraine the Latest is produced by Louisa Wells and Giles Gear. And today on Twitter, Sophie Coe.